Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with two assessments of the dangers posed to our civil liberties by the passage of the National Defence Authorisation Act, the President threatened to veto but now will sign. First, we speak with Scott Horton, who was a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. We'll try to understand why this law that the heads of our military and national security establishment did not want, that the civil liberties community is alarmed about, was not vetoed by the president. Then joining us for a further discussion of this bill that goes much further in militarizing law enforcement than anything the Bush-Cheney administration ever proposed is Azeez Huq, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is now a professor of law at the University of Chicago. We will examine the objections that civil libertarians and our top military and national security officials have about the bill and how much the compromise language that was sufficient for the president to withdraw his veto leaves open the possibility of a further erosion of the Bill of Rights and a future abuse of power. Then finally, we'll look into what the U.S. intelligence community lost in the capture of a top-secret state-of-the-art drone now in Iranian hands. One of the world's leading experts on mercenaries, robotics, and future warfare, Peter Singer, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative, joins us. We'll discuss how much of a treasure trove the largely intact Sentinel drone will be for the Russians and Chinese and how it ended up on display by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And yesterday I spoke with Shahid Batar, who's the head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, about the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 that is now before the Senate. The president previously threatened to veto it. Compromise language is put in to the point where the president apparently will sign it once it passes the Senate. But the impression that I was left with, and so was our audience, is quite alarming, that the Posse Comitatus Act has been overturned and that the First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments of the U.S. Constitution are in jeopardy. How do you read the current situation?
Well, I'll say that the sponsors of the legislation made clear in the number of statements that they made on the floor and elsewhere that the legislation is intended merely as a restatement of the law as it currently stands. It wasn't designed to change anything. But that being noted, they also advanced their own interpretations of what the current law was and how the current legislation would reinforce that. And one of the issues was, does the president have the power to order the arrest of an American citizen on American soil and have him carted away overseas somewhere and held in a military prison and tried before a military tribunal? And, you know, we have Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and several other senators saying, absolutely, yes, the president has that power and authority. I think that would come as a surprise to justices of the Supreme Court. I mean, as I count their opinions, at least five of the justices flatly said he didn't have that authority, including Antonin Scalia, who rejected that idea. But I think what we're seeing in this legislation is an attempt to chart out a basis for that sort of action. So this statute definitely could be abused in a very aggressive way. And I'd say the concerns that are being raised are raised with good reason, not because anyone thinks that Barack Obama is going to start arresting thousands of political opponents tomorrow and resting his authority on NDAA, but that some president at some point in the future might very well use this legislation and this initiative for that basis. Because the legislation says, essentially, if the president determines that someone is a terrorist acting in cahoots with Al-Qaeda, he can seize him and he can send him away to be held in a military justice system. So it's a unilateral, almost unreviewable decision by the president. And that, if you look back at the writings of Edmund Burke, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, that was described as the very essence of tyranny.
So as bad as that language is, my understanding is that much of this is a compromise, that Lindsey Graham's and the John McCain's and the Buck McKeon's were pushing in one direction, and in the other direction you had General Petraeus at the CIA, Panetta at the Defense Department, Hillary Clinton, President Obama, Brennan at counterterrorism, the Justice Department, National Security, Lisa Monaco, a whole pantheon of the national security establishment was against this. So it sounds like this is as bad as what you just said, that these powers are now vested in the president. How bad were they before this, and how much ambiguity is left?
Well, let's say that there were two major lines of argument against this legislation. And as best I can see, other than the people who sponsored the legislation and voted for it in Congress, nobody supported this legislation. I mean, the entire senior echelons of the national security apparatus said, no, this is stupid legislation or bad legislation. A retired FBI directors like William Sessions, very, very prominent Republican, said it's bad legislation. Generals like Kulak and Hoar said it was bad legislation. Supporting it basically were the actual authors of the legislation. But the attacks were along the lines that it undermined the authority of the president as executive to make decisions on one hand, and on the other hand, that it undermined the civil liberties of American citizens. And the compromise we got at the end was a compromise that shored up the authority of the president, but gave no ground whatsoever on the civil liberties issues. And Barack Obama decided, you shore up my presidential power and I'll sign it, to hell with the civil liberties issues. And that's very disturbing.
So what are then the civil liberties issues that leave us in jeopardy?
The most fundamental power or the most fundamental civil right is the right not to be deprived of your liberty by your government without accountability before courts, that you should be presented with charges and have a right to defend yourself from them. And this legislation takes that away, or nearly takes that away. So, you know, what it gives you is, the right to defend yourself before a military commission. And the U.S. and countries around the world has said that doesn't cut it. That's the fundamental abuse of human rights. Also, when we look at around the world at democratic societies that have been converted into dictatorships or authoritarian regimes, whether Europe between the wars, South Africa, we can look at Latin American examples. I think you could study literally dozens of countries. You'll find in almost every single case, the decision to collapse democracy rested on measures exactly like this, where the civil rights of the citizenry were taken away in favor of an executive's right to detain people or to hold people or imprison people without accountability, or substituting some sort of military system of accountability. So, this is a critical threat to democratic society.
So this is then a double whammy. The national security establishment was against it. The civil libertarians, as I dare not say they're an establishment, but they are doing the Lord's work here in protecting the Bill of Rights. We've all lost here. For what? I mean, why is this thing happening? My understanding is that Bin Laden's been killed and Al-Qaeda is only down to a few hundred people living in caves somewhere in the mountains of Pakistan. What has suddenly brought this upon the national agenda to the point where the president has had to bow to enough pressure to sign this ambiguous bill because of what?
Well, what's brought it on is 10 years of empty political rhetoric in which class after class of congressmen and representatives have been elected with this mantra of national security law, where they're intent on showing that they're stronger and more robust than anyone else. And the latest mantra is that the military system is better. We love the military. We can't criticize the military. Let's put all this on the shoulders of the military. And that's what has driven this measure. Now, the military doesn't want this. People in the Department of Defense I've talked with have told me that Congress needs to remember that it's Department of Defense, not Department of Detentions. It's not a core part of their mission to administer criminal justice or to run prison systems. That's not what they're there for. We have other institutions that do that. So they're really settling a huge unwanted burden on the military. But they're doing this as part of a sort of political game that suggests that this is stronger or more effective than the civilian system. And that's nonsense.
So is this because Lindsey Graham is a former JAG officer? I mean, I'm searching here for a rationale.
I don't think there is one. I think it's because, well, let's just go back to the beginning. You might call this measure the Gitmo Forever bill, because it aims to keep Guantanamo open forever and to provide a new stream of prisoners to be sent there. So I think one major, and frankly, you go back and you look at John McCain's speeches supporting this, and he spends more time attacking Barack Obama's pledge to shut down Guantanamo than he does justifying the legislation. And I think that's psychologically very revealing. The purpose of this legislation is to ensure that Barack Obama cannot fulfill his campaign pledge of closing Guantanamo. I really think that is the essence of it, and that's complete nonsense. And I think what's really shameful is that you had a handful of Democrats vote in support of this legislation.
Well, Scott Horton, again, professor at Columbia Law School and contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. And I'm calling you because I was so alarmed, and so was the audience, by yesterday's discussion about how much this bill jeopardizes the fundamental liberties of this country in the First and the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment, along with the Posse Comitatus Act that served the country well. And I thought, my God, you know, today it would be front page everywhere. There's nothing in the LA Times about it at all. And there's a page 26 article in the New York Times. So
it's only The Daily Show that's given this top coverage.
Well,
the fake news of a comedy program, which dealt with it in a deadly serious way, I think.
Well, I mean, he's an awfully intelligent and I think insightful fellow, John Stewart. And I guess that's another way of saying how our press have dropped the ball, right?
I think they have. I mean, I think most of them have accepted the view of the sponsors that, oh, this is just a very, very technical measure, nothing for you to be very worried about. And the civil libertarians who raise concerns about this are, you know, are hysterical. I mean, they're just not viewing this in a sober, careful way. But, you know, I think the bottom line is that this bill either confirms or creates unprecedented power in the president. And if a president were to interpret it and realize it and use it the way people like Lindsey Graham proposed, then, you know, it really would be a horrible thing. It would be shattering to civil liberties. Now, we had virtually every major paper in the country post an editorial against this legislation, including the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, Atlanta Constitution Journal, even relatively conservative newspapers opposed it. It got virtually no support in the press, but neither is the press gone out of its way to alert readers about the dangers that the legislation presents.
But you would think, though, that given Petraeus and General Hoare and General Krulak and the former heads of the FBI and the current head of the FBI, who still thinks that this legislation is very flawed because it has bad language and then it has compromised language, Mueller thinks it's going to lead to tremendous ambiguity. If a terrorist is captured, the FBI are going to be there, and then suddenly the military are going to show up too, and they're going to fight over who's going to put this person into custody.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, yesterday there was a meeting of the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives at which one of the representatives stood up and read from the Krulak and Hoare editorial and then read a letter that the former FBI director William Sessions had written, very prominent Republican, actually they're all prominent Republicans, in which they ridiculed and heavily attacked this legislation, and a group of members then started saying, why are we voting for this? Why are we supporting this? And the leadership had to quickly try and stamp it out. But I think that reflects exactly what the problem is. I mean, they're voting for legislation without really understanding it and understanding the negative potential that flows from it. So what's going on here is another major step in the militarization of our justice system, which is ridiculous. It's not what the military wants. It's not what any prudent person would want. And it's being done for short-term partisan political reasons. And I think if our Republican friends were to sit down and actually seriously think about what's being done here and read things like what Generals Krulak and Hoar had to say about it, they would pull back from this misstep.
Well, you've just told us, Scott, that at the Republican caucus, I believe also Dick Cheney spoke on behalf of it.
That's right.
So some prominent Republican who you chose not to name read from the editorial by Generals Krulak and Hoar and also articles by Sessions, the Republican former head of the FBI. That wasn't sufficient. The president, at the end of the day, has the bully pulpit, and he threatened the veto. It feels like he didn't want to make sufficient issue out of it neither. You know, Republican leadership obviously, you know, didn't have any answers, but they sort of buffaloed their caucus into line.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think, Ian, we're in a position where if the president had stepped up and said, I veto it, his veto would have been sustained. There have been, since this bill was originally passed, we've had a series of Republicans who voted for it come forward and say, I didn't understand when I voted for it what I was voting for. This is a mistake, and I've changed my mind. It's very, very clear that the president's veto would be sustained at this point, but the president has decided not to do this. And what's his attitude? Ultimately, this is a measure that gives immense power to the president. And I think the people around the president are delighted to have this power vested in the White House. And what we no longer see much of a trace of is the Barack Obama who in 2008 talked about the excesses of presidential power and promised to do something to dial that back. I mean, we've seen hardly a sign of that Barack Obama in the last 2 years.
So, since I'm here at Hollywood, I'm right across the street from Universal Studios as I speak to you, Scott, I see a movie script here that there's somebody that the president doesn't like, and this person is arrested and disappeared. Is that possible?
Absolutely, it's possible. I mean, under this legislation, a presidential determination that someone is a terrorist acting in conjunction with Al-Qaeda or an associated terrorist group, that's all he needs to do to have the person removed and put down in military detention somewhere beyond the borders of the United States. That is effectively disappeared.
So in other words, if Vladimir Putin had this ability, he'd be doing it right away, right?
Yes, he does have this ability.
I mean, he does. Frankly,
he does these things, yes. And that's, I think, one of the differences between American democracy and democracies of other states. I'd say more authoritarian states around the world vest these powers in their executive, and more democratic states do not. And in fact, you know, at the time of our revolution, there was one point on which the founding fathers were very, very clear, and that is you could not give this kind of power alone to the executive. That, you know, the executive was going to propose to do something involving taking the liberty of a citizen or a resident of the country that had to be subject to challenge and review by a court. And that doesn't mean a military tribunal. Military tribunal composed of officers appointed by the president, not applying the same standards that our Constitution envisions.
So just in closing then, Scott Horton, what are citizens to do about this? I'm not as alarmed as I was yesterday because there's compromise in this, but you've made a very strong case that it's in the law, and if Obama decides or is not bent on abusing his powers, his successors might well, and that the people that even voted for it have buyer's remorse already. What's the citizen to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I go further and say, I don't think Barack Obama would abuse this. If you look at the way he's governed the last 3.5 years, last 3 years, he's actually been pretty cautious in his use of this sort of power. But I think, you know, a future president might very well do that. So what should the citizen do? I mean, the citizen should write his or her congressmen and senators and tell them they're upset about this legislation and they don't support the militarization of the criminal justice system. That should stop. Frankly, you know, our criminal justice system, our constitutional standards are an asset for the country. That's what General Hoar and General Krulak wrote in their editorial. They said this reflects our ideals. It's something we should be proud of. And in fact, it is it's a weapon that the country can use. It's something that helps us in our battle overseas, not something to hide from.
And, of course, as you've pointed out, the military doesn't even want these powers. So the whole thing is really bizarre. I thank you for joining us, Scott.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, where he also writes the No Comment blog. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, serves on the American branch of the International Law Association, and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment with another opinion on how grave the threat is to our civil liberties.
Prefer to chain my will onto the wings of my instinct and wander around this box. I'm inextricably linked. You know I'm